TFM.
Welcome, Stargazers, to another episode of The Artificial Tango, our dedicated Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I just want to say thank you so much for loaning me that 8-track of Baby, that Texas rock band. I mean, listening to that song, Star Child, at the start of this episode, it really got me in the mood.
Well, you're welcome, Chris. I knew that you would love it, and I was immediately brought back to, 2009, when Kirk hits the oldies button and, it's Sabotage playing.
Yeah, right.
And I was just thinking, I was like, I'm so glad that people in the 25th century can still appreciate great music.
Yeah, think about it. How old... I was in a place having dinner the other night. They were playing 1920s jazz. And I thought, this music is 100 years old now. And this song, Star Child, is what, 500 years old? 400? I'm not good at math, but they're in the 25th century and we're talking about a late 20th century band.
I mean, Picard's mixtape that he made for Beverly was even older than that. So,
exactly.
It's nice to know that the music from this time period, that nobody else has done music that people want to listen to, which is understandable because, anything from all the way to the 20s to the 80s is fantastic.
It's excellent. All right. Well, that is how the episode kicked off. I loved that. Jumping on a starship, take me on a trip. Anyway, let's just get into the discussion here, and we're going to start off with a few corrections, because we had great fun speculating last time, but it turns out that we were off base on one key point in particular, and that is the timing of this story.
Yeah, this was something that I know happened for a lot of the sites and a lot of places, I blame a little bit Memory Alpha going to do some research there and them putting the time the year that this takes place is 2411. But we had a great intrepid listener over on the Babel Conference, so thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. We really appreciate it. It means people are actually listening to the show, which... we love, Metalis actually said that this season probably takes place a year and a half to maybe 2 years beyond Picard, the second season, which I think makes a lot more sense, obviously. And,
overall,
it's still, yeah. And it still means that, Nemesis came out in 2002, this show premieres in February 2023. So it's been 20 years and 2 months since Crusher and Jean-Luc have met each other or seen each other. And so there's been quite a lot of time that's passed between and for these characters. So I think it makes, again, even more sense for this to be the case.
Yeah. Yeah. Overall, it makes more sense. I do like the idea of it being a little bit more time personally. I think a year in year and a half, 2 years is a little bit close in terms of things like Seven's role on the Titan A at this point, but I think it still works pretty well. One thing that was pointed out, which I just wanted to mention because I think that some of the confusion, not only for us, I mean, our jump was quite long, 10 years, but I know that other people have also been unclear about when this takes place. And I do wish that in the writing there was a little bit more clarity. I know Star Trek has never been precise in the passage of time and exactly when an episode takes place and when one doesn't. And sometimes actually the star dates put a story earlier than the one that came before it. But in this case, there's the moment where in the first episode where Raffi is looking at this computer projection of her granddaughter. And some people have pointed out that there's your math right there. Obviously it can't be too long because her granddaughter, her son and his wife were pregnant in season one, and now the granddaughter couldn't be that old. But when I look at something like that, just as a viewing an episode for the first time, we don't know when that recording was made, right? We cannot assume, and we shouldn't be expected to assume as viewers, that that is a recent recording. For all we know, Raffi could be pining over the loss of her granddaughter, and it's another tragedy in her life, and she's spent years trying to get over that. And especially because at that point, we're being presented Raffi as having fallen back down into her addictions. And it becomes clear very quickly that she's on a mission, but it's just a little bit muddy there. And so I don't think that something like that can necessarily be taken as evidence of the timing of the story. But at any rate, we were quite a few years off on this one, but now we know we'll go with, you know, like a year and a half or 2 years range probably.
Well, I do want to say too, and I think you're 100% right. I think we forget, and in all honesty, growing up in the era when, you know, you had photo albums and, you know, you would be looking at albums that started when the person was a baby and moving forward. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Raffi could be looking at any holo recording that she has of her grandbaby because, you know, she may have a collection of them. And so I think you're 100% right on that. And so I think I'm with you. I think that to me, the 2 years makes sense. I don't really have a problem with Seven being on the Titan and being where she is. She obviously has a ton of experience,
you know,
having been on Voyager. She's been in command, basically, and leadership when it comes to her role in the Fenris Rangers. And so I think when you also have Picard and Janeway, two of the Titans of Starfleet at this point, you know, who's going to argue with them as to whether or not this person that they're vouching for?
Well, Shaw would argue with them.
Well, that's true.
He doesn't
seem
to have much respect for those seasoned veterans of Starfleet.
It's true. But, you know, I think, you know, other people in Starfleet tend to agree, obviously, with Janeway and Picard in this. And so, but one thing that we did forget to mention last time, and I always felt terrible the fact that we did, but I loved at the end of the last episode that we had the credits, before the credits started, they just said for Annie. And, you know, losing Annie Wiersching, who, of course, played the Borg Queen and passed away on January 29th, was heartbreaking. And so I'm very glad that they did this for her, and just a way to honor her and her contribution, not only to Star Trek, but just in general. You know, an actress that I loved seeing in any show that she was in. And I think she did a phenomenal job as the Borg Queen. And sadly, she is going to be missed.
Yeah. Absolutely. And of course, she also appeared in the episode Oasis on Enterprise. And but for the purpose of this discussion with Picard, obviously her role last season as the Borg Queen was the highlight of her Star Trek portion of her career. And it was really shocking, that news that she passed away. So many people are passing away recently that are familiar to us. Obviously, this is, I've thought about this a bit as I'm getting older, and I see more and more people who I'm very familiar with passing away. Of course, this has to be the same for everybody over time, because there's just this rolling roster of people who you know from the arts. Those are the most high-profile people that we think of. But recently, so many people that, of course, I grew up with have been passing away. But for Annie, she was still so young, it was really shocking to get that news.
Yeah.
Very sad.
Yeah. I mean, you know, she was only a few years older than I am. And so,
younger than me.
That was, absolutely shocking to have happen. And so sad that she's gone. But I'm glad that they did this for her. One last correction that we had was that I mentioned that I thought that there was a changeling on the Bridge of the Titan, and it's not a changeling. Thank you for Terry Metalis for putting a picture of this new alien race on Twitter. And they are Nanacam, I think is how you would pronounce them. Mm-hmm. Cool alien design. I think it's very interesting looking, and definitely you can understand why in the background where things are slightly blurred, you would think it is a changeling.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe that'll, you know, still happen. But very, maybe Terry was listening.
Maybe so. I hope so. If so, hello, Terry. We love what you're doing here with Picard. As for this alien, if you see the design of the alien in those action scenes across the bridge, dark bridge, blurry, it could easily be mistaken for a changeling. And it would have been a cool plot point or evolution of the Star Trek universe if some changelings had become part of Starfleet, mm-hmm. although mm-hmm. might be a little bit too soon on the timeline. But and speaking of also not being sure about races on the bridge, there is also an officer who I kept thinking might be a Romulan because of the Romulan story elements of Picard and mm-hmm. how those relations have evolved. But the character is indeed Vulcan. And this is the science officer, Lieutenant Tavin, who we see bald, mm-hmm. got the ears. The design of the ears are a little bit different than what we're familiar with Vulcans. And that's a primary mm-hmm. reason why I thought maybe it's a Romulan design. But anyway.
Yeah. I can understand why.
Yeah. So that one caught my eye as well as we're looking at the bridge crew.
So, Chris, I was thinking of a question before we dive into the whole discussion and something we didn't really ask last time, but I was thinking about, especially watching the episode, we didn't talk about the new Starfleet uniforms, and I really wanted to know what your thoughts were on these new Starfleet uniforms, which have bits and pieces from many of the uniforms we've had over the years, and so how do you think these hold up to, say, like, the Monster Maroon or the, you know, First Contact uniforms, which I know two of those are your favorites and mine as well.
Well, I have to say that the Monster Maroons and the Deep Space Nine / First Contact uniforms remain my favorites. But these uniforms, I have to say I really love them because one thing is they don't stand out to me like, oh my gosh, look what they've done with the uniforms this time. They feel more familiar, like you've got the color scheme of the Voyager uniforms, but they feel more refined. They don't feel so much like the jumpsuits that those were. They feel more like proper uniforms.
Yes.
And I think they look really classy. When you look at it, you feel this is Star Trek. This is the look from the 90s. And it feels updated, but it doesn't feel like it's over-designed, which has been something that I think has happened to a lot of the uniforms that we've gotten on the newer shows.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, I 100% agree with you. One of the things that, I just rewatched Star Trek Insurrection, and even though I love the First Contact uniforms and beyond that they were using, I hated that some of them were jumpsuits and others mm-hmm. were actual, like Picard is the only one who seemed to have an actual jacket. Mm-hmm. And these uniforms all seem to be jacket tops,
right,
like the Monster Maroon. They even have, looks like the flap you could pull down. Mm-hmm. So somebody better have an open flap in this season or I'm going to be really upset.
Yeah. With the blood stain on it?
Yes. There you go. It better happen. But I think that, like you were saying, it doesn't feel like it's been over-designed. It feels like a natural extension of the uniforms that we've gotten beforehand. And again, I like that all of these feel as though every person is wearing a jacket-type top with trousers instead of having it be a jumpsuit, which mm-hmm. I never enjoyed especially on Voyager and Deep Space Nine in those early seasons, I never enjoyed that jumper look.
Yeah. Well,
And so
the concept behind the jumpsuits, which first appeared on DS9, makes sense. The idea that they're in an environment where they need something that's a bit more functional than what they would be wearing on the bridge of a starship. So in that sense, I got it, but I didn't like the look of them and the way that they fit the characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, totally agree with you. So I'm glad that we both like them. I even love the, I think the, the new Delta that mm-hmm. they've been using for this era is really cool.
Yeah,
nice mixture between all good things and something else. And so, Chris, we've got to talk about the sun in the room. It's not the elephant in the room. It's the sun in the room. And my friend, you were 100% right, is that this is Jean-Luc's son. And the reason that I am confident in saying that is because there have been articles on every single major news site with Terry Metalis talking about this idea. And I don't think they would do that if there was some twist later on coming.
No, I don't think so.
So I did want to ask you, though, how you do feel about the fact that this is confirmed now that Jack is Jean-Luc's son through Beverly, and that, you know, this is a child of theirs that happened sometime, most likely after Nemesis, before Beverly disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Well, I felt like Gates McFadden sold it all with her facial expression near the end of the episode. Yeah.
That scene, oh my gosh, that scene.
She didn't need to speak a word, but if you just look at her eyes and the way she looked at Jean-Luc and then his reaction, it's like they had a whole connection right there without ever speaking a word. And I thought it was brilliant the way that Gates played that. And the fact that he is their son, I think, makes a lot of sense. And I agree that I don't think they would set this up, put it out there, and then put in a twist with 8 episodes to go, because as much as you've got this great villain here, as much as you've got probably a lot of things coming up, because we already know from the trailers that Moriarty shows up and Lore shows up and all kinds of stuff's going to happen. With all that going on, I still feel like the core of this season is the Beverly Jean-Luc story. And having them have a son together is the thread that will run through that story, I believe. And so I think it makes perfect sense to have him there. Now, what did you think in this episode? Because throughout the episode, they're dropping these hints that, yeah, this is their son. And of course, apparently one of Riker's key jobs here is to keep telling Picard that this kid is your son. You know, he says, Beverly's son? There's just something familiar about him. And then later there's that whole conversation where Riker says, why are you dancing around this? Around what? Are you serious? And Picard says, well, even if he is Beverly's son, and if these charges are real, and Riker says, that is not what it's about, and you know it. Are you not seeing what I'm seeing? Do the math, Jean-Luc. And so Riker's going to keep reminding him. But there's also that moment where it seems like they're going to be destroyed. And Jack looks at Jean-Luc and says, well, it was nice meeting you, which to me felt a little bit like him acknowledging, it was nice to meet you finally, Dad. He didn't say it, but I just kind of took it that way. And then in the end, of course, it is confirmed. But what did you think about them trying to throw us off the trail one more time when it was revealed that he's Jack Camby, John Carson, James Cole, and Jarlis Carvel? And it seemed like he was someone who had somehow infiltrated Beverly's life, which I don't know how that would work because he keeps calling her mom, but we didn't get her point of view yet. So we don't know. Like maybe Beverly would wake up and go, I've never seen this kid in my life. Or he was just someone that was working with me and he's making all this up. You know, we don't know. So they tried to throw us off track once in the middle of the episode. What did you think about that?
You know, I thought it was good in the sense of, you know, trying to create the tension in the episode and to, you know, basically do the thing that everybody, you know, the episode allows the episode itself to ask the question that we're all asking, is this real? And then it turns out it is. And what I thought was great is that this felt so real for Picard to try and compartmentalize this question, because, and especially when I think about the idea that this is only a couple of years after his experience that just happened with Q, where he's been able to kind of put to rest his feelings about what happened with his mother and his fear. You know, he's been having this relationship with Laris, and life is getting a little bit more open. And this, I think, is the last big fear of Picard's, right? Like, I think, you know, a lot of people have said that this is tropey and all this type of stuff for them to have a kid. But if you watch Star Trek The Next Generation, and then you watch the films, and you've watched Picard, there is a theme that is running through that going all the way back to Encounter at Farpoint, which is Picard and the way that he feels about children, as well as Picard's fatherly aura that he ends up having for a lot of different characters. You know, for The Next Generation, it turns out to be Wesley, as well as other people. You know, there are, you could even put Will in that, Will Riker, in the sense that, you know, there's a fatherliness that, that Picard has always had towards him, and mm-hmm. protection, and, you know, a lot of his crew, even though it takes Picard a very long time to get very close with them, he still has that. Of course, with Picard itself, the series, you've got Soji and Rios as characters. And heck, you could even put Seven in this as well, mm-hmm. as people yeah. who Picard has been a father figure to. So to have the one big last thematic element for this character is that we're not only going to broach the subject of what happened with him and Beverly, but we're also going to broach the subject of what it would mean for him to actually be a father. I mean, when you think all the way back to Generations, where he believes him to be the last Picard,
mm-hmm.
there will be no more Picards, mm-hmm. and that he's resigned to that because he doesn't believe that he'll ever have a relationship because, you know, as we learned in season two, he's got this mental and emotional and psychological block to being able to actually be with anyone. All those walls are down. And now to find out that he has a child, I think is such an incredibly beautiful story point to play with that. And for it to obviously, it has to be Crusher this is happening with. Because right. that's the long lost unrequited love of his life. And so to me, I think they play it really well in the episode. And so I don't see the tropiness of it. I just see it as the natural outflowing of everything that we've been getting with this character from his introduction to everything that the series that Picard is doing. And this is where I think that Metalis is actually doing an incredible job of utilizing all the things that have been happening in the series Star Trek Picard, paying homage to them and making some serious lemonade out of some of the lemons that we had had in this series. And so to me, it absolutely works to be doing this in the first place.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a really good point. And especially because how Picard handles having a son in this situation will also challenge his own views and ideals and ethics, because even though they tried to throw us off the trail by revealing that Jack is known by all these other names, the reality is, it seems that this is legitimate. He actually is wanted on all these worlds, and he has been using aliases, and he has been doing something that maybe in his own mind is for the greater good, but he has been breaking laws in the process. And it's not going to be a nice, clean, tidy Jean-Luc saying, oh, wonderful, I have a son, and my son is following my footsteps. It's going to be, mm-hmm. here is someone who's my son, who is apparently very different than me and does things that I wouldn't do. And also, he was raised by Beverly, which brings into question, what has Beverly been doing right. for the last 20 years? And I think that's going to be a really interesting part of the story also, is how is Beverly involved in the things that this boy has done? Mm-hmm. Because the two of them together are part of this group called the Mariposa Medical, which is itself a nod to the series, because that is the group that Rios and Teresa founded when Rios stayed behind in the 21st century at the end of season two. And so that was a nice little nod of and a bit of continuity through the series, mm-hmm. even as, like I said last time, they're drastically changing the tone of the series, but they're still honoring what came before. But, you know, I Beverly as a character, I think, a lot better than I do, because she's one of your favorite characters, and also you've got all the litverse the litverse story of her and what went on after what we saw on the screen. So where do you think they might be going in terms of her involvement in any of this, and what mm-hmm. the two of them were doing as medical practitioners trying to help others?
Mm-hmm. So it was, I've been staying up late to watch the episodes when they drop here, which is midnight. And mm-hmm. I went to sleep. And as I'm trying to go to sleep, I'm thinking of, you know, what? My mind was like, okay, what would cause Beverly to kind of disappear? And what would be a legitimate reason for her doing that, which would make sense so that once people hear it, they don't think, oh, Beverly was horrible for keeping her child, Picard's mm-hmm. child away from him.
Right.
And so the only thing that I could come up with is that we know Picard has had aromatic syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And I am wondering if that their child had a genetic defect like that or something else that would need the type of genetic enhancements that Julian needed. We know those are still outlawed in the Federation. And it also harkens back to the idea of the first season of Picard, where we found out the Riker's son had died because there was a medical treatment that he needed that was illegal because it had to do with positronic natures.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, all of that tech had been eliminated in the Federation at that point because of what happened on Mars. And so it felt like a nice kind of mirror for that. And then a good mirror from the 24th century with, you know, we know Metallus has said that this is going to have allusions to not just TNG, but all of the 21st century shows like Deep Space Nine and Voyager. And so that was the only thing I could think of, is that would keep Beverly away, because what she's done with her son is illegal. So therefore, it would be... it's not such a step to see her kind of step into this role with Jack as he's growing up, raise him in this place where, yeah, they're going around and doing good deeds in places, but, you know, sometimes those good deeds need them to bend or break the wall a little bit to make sure that those things happen. And so that's what made sense to me, because I couldn't really think of another reason why she could leave Picard, and for the audience to be like, oh, okay, that makes sense, and not be angry at Beverly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing you don't want to have happen. So that's kind of where my mind went. And I have a good feeling that that's honestly where they'll end up, because I don't know. Is there anything else? Did you think of anything that would make sense?
Well, no, I don't have a theory on that, and I really like yours because it makes a lot of sense for the stories we've gotten in the past, for what we know about Picard, and if Jack is indeed genetically half Jean-Luc, there is a possibility, yeah, that he would have the syndrome, and I feel like Beverly would find a way to provide the treatment that's necessary. And she would, if it required her to leave Starfleet and leave Federation space, and maybe she cut off contact with everyone because she didn't want anyone else to be complicit in what she's doing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think it makes a lot of sense. So I really like that theory.
Well, and you think about, you know, Julian's father ends up going to prison because of what happened,
mm-hmm.
you know, when it's found out. And so it 100% makes sense that she would not want anybody to be liable for what she is going to do. You know, I also think that the credits have a lot of genetic DNA mm-hmm. strands in them. And so the only other reason I could think of why this would be the case and why Jack would be wanted by Vadic in the first place specifically has to do with his genetic makeup. And So I that was the other place my mind went to kind of start to connect the dots for why Jack would be wanted by this villain. Mm-hmm. And two, you know, what I thought is interesting, and maybe I don't know if you agree with me about this, but I feel like Jack himself feels like that kind of rogue that Picard was when we watched him in Tapestry.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
You know, he Picard then had a little bit more of that outlandishness that, you know, when you think about the fact that he was in a fight with some Nausicaans. Mm-hmm. That feels like the Jack that we're getting here.
True.
So yeah. I really do feel like Metalis had gone through and kind of watched all of the different places where you see Picard kind of break out of that shell that we know for him in the 24th century. And, you know, he doesn't really seem all that different from the Picard that we saw there. And like his father, he's willing to do what it takes to make sure that everybody else is safe, regardless of his own safety, especially those he cares about. So, Right. You know, I feel like a lot of this really fits together pretty well.
Right. And that reminds me, too, going back to Insurrection. So last week I had fun speculating on whether the Sona might be involved here. I'll come back to that in a moment. But talking about doing what's necessary and Picard, we see that in Insurrection, where, you know, he feels that the Baku are being treated wrongly, and he actually goes against orders, takes matter into his own hands, and takes action. And that drive is similar to, I think, what might be going on with Jack here, where he's doing things that are getting him into trouble, but he's doing them because he sincerely believes that he is helping people.
No, I 100% agree with you. And I think, you know, again, the more that I have, it's one of those things, you know, when you're watching these episodes and you're doing it one at a time, the more that I've kind of thought about the rationale and why these big things are happening and these characters or whatever, I'm continually being able to find connections in places where it's like, oh, okay, I can see how that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And that makes, you know, and so it's confirmation to me that the writers here, Metalis and everyone else and everyone involved in this season was very cognizant of everything that had come before and wanting to craft a story to which, when you did think about it, you're like, I can see the rationale for that and why that's the case, and it not feel as though there's this major leap in logic. And so that's awesome. You know, I mean, and I think that's what's made for the best Star Trek. You know, we love Deep Space Nine. We've been walking through the rewatch of Enterprise, and those are both shows to which I think when they're at their best, that's what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. And mentioning writers, we keep talking about Terry Metalis a lot, and he wrote the first episode, and of course is the mastermind behind the season. This episode was written by Christopher Monfett and Sean Tretta, so just throw that out there and give them credit for the story that they're putting together for us here as well. The Sona, while I mention Insurrection, I guess we can talk about, I want to talk about the ship a little bit, but actually the genetic part that we were just talking about a moment ago is sort of a bridge to this, because I don't think any longer that the Sona themselves are involved, although that was an interesting thing. But this Captain Vadik, this villain that we're getting here, you mentioned that maybe the reason she wants Jack is that it has something to do with his genetic makeup. And I still get the feeling that in a similar way to the Sona, there might be something here where, like, she wants something from that genetic makeup because she needs it. I don't know. The way the character is portrayed and the way that even the makeup, the appearance, the way that they've made her look like she is quite old, and sort of like, I put in my notes that it was like a restrained, unhinged portrayal is how I described it in my notes for myself. And there's something about her that it feels like somebody who is slowly losing their mind, and they need something and they're pursuing it in a way that's more and more reckless. And they've gathered the force that they need to get what they want. And because of, in the closing credits, we see so much having to do with DNA and genetics. I just think that there's something there in the story beyond the idea of, is Jack the son of Beverly and Jean-Luc?
Right. Yeah, I like that you mentioned that. You know, one of the things that I, in my notes, I took down was that she feels like Khan and Joker had a baby.
That's a good point. And, yeah.
And, you know, because she seems to be a character that really revels in her power. You know, right. She's called her ship the Shrike, which is based off of a bird on Earth, which is, you know, methodical and calculating. And that seems to be who she is. She seems to have been somebody who's really thought out her plan here. And, you know, of course, it also helps that her ship is completely overloaded with weapons, especially banned weapons. And to mention the Sona, she has isolytic bursts, which we saw used in Insurrection, which tears subspace. She uses a tractor beam as a weapon. I mean, she uses a tractor beam to throw a ship at the Titan, which was just an incredible move, which if I remember, I was reading somewhere, I can't remember where, but there's a way that you could do that in one of the Star Trek video games. I think it was like Star Trek Klingon or something, where they talk about the idea of that anything can be a weapon on a ship. And so that was fantastic. And I think I got that feeling too, just from her specifically, that there's something that she personally wants with Jack. And what that is going to be very interesting. And somehow, I feel like that has to tie into lore and to Moriarty. And yet, I can't quite figure out what that is. Now, with Moriarty, I'm wondering if it would have to do with his own nature, in the sense that he was somebody who stepped out of the holodeck and became an actual person. So is there something about, you know, Jack's genetic makeup that would be needed for that? And is that also the same thing for Lore, too?
Right. Although, if you remember, Moriarty did not step out of the holodeck and become a real person. He created a simulation within the simulation. And then
this is true. Yeah.
Yeah. And the ultimate fate of him, and I actually just rewatched Ship in a Bottle a couple of nights ago. His ultimate fate is that he's in this little cube that keeps the simulation
so that
going.
Maybe he wants to be a real boy.
Right.
I want to be a real boy.
But it's going to be interesting as to how he reappears, because, again, he's not a normal hologram. So even though he didn't step out into the real world, he's not a normal hologram. And for him to come back now means that somehow that cube that is storing his pattern and allowing him to live out his life, which he thinks is real and he thinks is off the holodeck, had to be protected and passed along somehow, which is very interesting to me, because remember, this was aboard the Enterprise D, and the Enterprise D was destroyed. It crashed. So that means the cube remained intact and was taken from the wreckage of the ship and has continued to survive for all these years. I'm going to be really curious to see how that comes into play. But I guess we shouldn't be talking so much about Moriarty right now, because he's not even in this episode.
Yeah, I just, I think in all, I found Vadic to be a very interesting villain. You know, in many ways, of course, I think you can see the similarities between her and General Chang, too.
Yeah. Well, even some of the dialogue is similar.
I love that she's smoking the cigar that reminds me of Marta on Star Trek VI well. You know, very similar there. So I think that was fantastic to see. And you know, I think what I liked about her introduction here is that she's really intriguing, mm-hmm. and it makes you want to know more about her without yeah. revealing too much. Yeah. So I think that part is the where I'm just thinking, that's really well done.
Yeah. Well, she has that unhinged nature in the way Khan did, the in the Wrath of Khan, and there's just something. She's a big screen villain. I mean, that's one thing I was thinking about, the fact that even as it's been described by Metalis, that these episodes are like the final movie that the Next Generation crew didn't get. You get that feeling here too, that, you know, this is not a TV villain. This is a big screen villain. And I just, the, you know, we don't know much yet, but I will just say that the portrayal, Amanda Plummer's portrayal here, I thought was really brilliant and creepy and eerie. And you know she wants something and you don't know what it is yet. And she's got so much power behind her that all they can do at this point is what they do at the end of the episode, which is run,
right?
You know, they're not going to be able to face off against her. And it's just going to be fascinating to see where this goes. And I don't yet, other than what we've already talked about, where her probably wanting something to do with Jack's genetics, I am not sure. But do you feel like the plot with her, as we've seen it right now, and the attack on the Starfleet recruitment center is connected? Or are these two separate storylines?
I feel like it has to be some way, because, you know, they talk about, you know, when they do the 2 weeks before and the quote unquote Fenris Rangers show up, you know, they say that they found him and to tell the marked woman. Well, she definitely kind of feels like a marked woman. She has these weird marks on her face, if you look carefully. And so I believe that they're somehow connected to all of this. And, you know, we know from the Rafi storyline that, you know, the quote-unquote suspect that they have was absolutely not the true person that was behind this, this bombing using this tunneling tech. And so, you know, I'm just left with, Chris, I don't know much, but I know she scares me. And so, and that may be all I ever need to know. But, you know, no, they're going to give us plenty more with her. And I think that so far the series has done a good job of not allowing major questions just linger forever. But, you know, when you're first just kind of introducing her as the villain, you know, I think they gave us just enough. Now, the thing that also I'm connecting with this as well is that her people also wear these masks. And I'm also wondering, you know, who are they underneath those masks? Or I guess to put it musically, Shakir would said, underneath your clothes. I want to know what's there, you know, what's going on. And I'm wondering, too, if the people that are with her as well, like, is it this group of people? And this is kind of where I enjoyed your Sona idea. Like, are these the type of people who there is something genetically not right? And therefore, this is going to play into all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, there's just a lot of great questions here. And I find myself enjoying the speculation and trying to figure out what it is, while at the same time just willing to allow the show to give me the answers that it will as we move forward.
Yeah, that's where my Sona idea came from, is that there just does seem to be something there, and the genetic part, there seems to be something there that not only is she after it, but these aliens working with her are also in need of something. One thing I found interesting in this episode is that in the first episode, Jack mentions that every time that they have met these people, they appear differently. And here he specifically says the first time they were Fenris Rangers, which we saw in this episode in the flashback. The second time they were Klingons. The third, they were three guys in Starfleet uniforms, which sounds like these aliens are actually able to change their appearance. And you know, the Fenris Ranger guy that we see at the start of this episode, he's either been injured or he's not quite good at doing faces.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, yeah. It could be that these people are changelings, which I don't think is the case, but if they are aliens who are changing their appearance, that's one idea. If we want to do a deep cut into Voyager, you've got the Silverblood, the mm-hmm. aliens that Voyager met on the demon planet, who we know have imitated them and taken human form. And then you've got Species 8472, who created the fake Starfleet Academy that we saw in Voyager. So there are aliens that we've encountered that can change their appearance and could be a hook into this if we're going to pull in threads from Voyager and DS9 and elsewhere. And I'm not sure that I really think that any of those are the case here, but it sounds like from the description that Jack has given us that these aliens are mm-hmm. able to change their appearance.
That could definitely be the case. And, you know, we also, Star Trek VI has a shapeshifter in it as well, mm-hmm. you know.
Who likes to smoke, as you've pointed out.
Exactly. A metalloid, I think, is what they're called, if I remember correctly. So, yeah, I think the thing about this is there are a lot of different ways in which this can play out. And I think, as of now, only two episodes in, I think I like the fact that I can't figure it all out, right?
Yeah.
You know, maybe when I get to the end of the show, I'll be like, oh, I see how they had planted that. But I am thankful that there is not this feeling for myself is that I know how everything's going to play out, because that would be really boring. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one of the things that was obviously a big part of this episode was Rafi's story and mm-hmm. her struggling with the aftermath of what happened there at Sector 7 on Metallus Prime. Mm-hmm. And she is told to disengage by her handler. And instead of disengaging, she goes to visit her ex-husband, who apparently lives on Metallus Prime. Mm-hmm. And we get a taste of what went wrong with them, and the fact that, you know, he apparently was an ex-conspiracy theorist and a druggie, and he got clean because of their son. He's now an artist, but he still kind of lives in the low life because he's got a bar where seedy people hang out, and that's where she's wanting to meet this broker, Sneed, who she believes brokered the deal for the weapon that was used there. And so all of this to me was an interesting exploration of that character, and where we kind of see Rafi battling with her demons. I mean, she's made to choose between having a good word put on her with her son and having to basically think of the many instead of the one. Mm-hmm. Which I you know, I've absolutely love that idea. I think it's really such a Star Trek thing to choose mm-hmm. between those two things. And so how did this part of the storyline end up working for you, especially when, you know, we meet Sneed and he's a Ferengi, which was kind of fun to see. You know, I haven't watched Discovery. I know the Ferengi have showed up there, but it was kind of fun to see a Ferengi in this episode with facial hair.
Yeah. Well, the Ferengi we see in Discovery are in the far future, and we don't see them extensively as we do here with Sneed. As far as Rafi goes, yeah, I liked that they did this with her story, because it's a continuation from the very first time we met her. It's just an ongoing struggle with her. And you know that she would love more than anything to have a relationship with her son. And that's, I'm sure, one reason why in the first episode we see her looking at the projection of her granddaughter, because she wants to spend mm-hmm. time with her granddaughter, of course. But there's this other thing that's driving her. And I think she is a person who gets pulled along by conspiracy theories. She enjoys following these trails. I think that's something that really drives her. And maybe mm-hmm. her ex-husband was like that and then came clean, as you said. And she feels like someone who wants to climb out of that, but just can't. And in this situation, she feels responsible for all of these deaths, these 117 right. Starfleet recruits and probably some officers who were killed, because she wasn't able to solve the case quickly enough and she wasn't able to warn them in time. And then she watched it happen and she feels responsible. And so even though she would love to take the offer of her ex-husband for him to put in a good word for her with their son, she just can't. To her, that would be a selfish act just for her. And she feels like right. she has to, as she says in here, speak for the dead and follow this trail and try to figure out what happened. And I do think, like right now, it feels like, I asked you earlier, do you think these are two separate stories? Because the way it's presented right now, it's very disjointed. We've got everything else that's going on, and then we've got Raffi's thing that's going on. But I do think ultimately that these will be connected. And when they scan the Shrike, they mentioned that there's something loaded in primary position in the bay, technology unknown. Now, I don't know for sure that that's a reference to what was stolen from the Daystrom station. It could just highlight the fact that this Captain Vadic collects weaponry and technology. But I do think there's a connection between the two things going on, and that the stolen technology that was used to destroy the recruitment center and that Raffi is chasing here is somehow going to make its way to Vadic, yeah. or Vadic is involved. You know, they say there's an anonymous buyer here. Maybe she's the buyer or someone on her behalf. There's like a chain going on. Something like that could be happening. But yeah, for Raffi, I think it's a good story element. And then when she meets Sneed, putting her in a situation where actually her druggy past is helping her mm-hmm. a bit in this situation. Right. It's just making a rich character, and she's a very flawed person and she's really struggling with a lot of things. And I think it makes her very real mm-hmm. because I think that's most real people are like that. Maybe they're not former druggies like she is here, but there's something that normal people do struggle with. And so it makes her real.
I think one of the things that I liked about this too is that, and you know, her husband gets on her as if she can't let this go. But mm-hmm. what I was seeing here is that, and everything we've seen so far with this season and in last season is that Raffi had been able to put behind her drug past, but she is actually using her proclivity for looking into conspiracy theories for good. In Starfleet intelligence to track down these things, to see if these rumors are actually true. She's been given the power to actually be able to do that and empowered by whoever her handler is, which we learn is actually Worf. So I was I was excited to be right about that.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
man,
yeah.
Talk about an entrance.
Well, after our discussion last week and you bringing up that you thought it's Worf who's the handler, and I kept thinking about it more and more and thinking, yeah, that's spot on, because the wording and the cadence of the dialogue that we were getting from the handler through the computer, it really did match Worf really well. And I thought for sure, yeah, definitely Matthew's right. And then when the exchange started in this episode between Raffi and the handler, and I started watching what the handler was saying, instantly, I thought, it definitely Worf. It definitely sounds like Worf. And so I knew for sure that it was going to be Worf. And sure enough, it was there at the end. And when he made that entrance, then I knew for sure, because I'm like, okay, Batleth out or whatever he's using. And Worf is in the house. And she wanted a face-to-face meeting with the handler, and she got it. And luckily for her, she got it, because mm-hmm. if he hadn't shown up, then who knows what would have happened to her. But I think that also yeah. highlights Worf's role and his past in security and then in command. And he's on top of things. Like, he knows what's going on. He's going to lay back mm-hmm. until he's needed, but he knew what he knew she was going to need him.
Well, and I think the interesting question that I ended up having because of this episode was, you know, why was he telling her to disengage? Is it because he knew the story to be false and was waiting for more leads to send Rafi out on? Or is it because maybe he knows the connection? And that's the question that I was left with, because it did seem, if Worf understands that this is truly what, you know, Tuluko was not the actual mm-hmm. person responsible, and then somebody has to be responsible. And, you know, why wouldn't he want her to be looking into that? And so mm-hmm. I think those are some interesting questions that need to be answered. And I honestly don't quite have an answer for that, other than the fact that, again, maybe Worf is aware of more, of course, than she is, and therefore that he has a good reason, which I would expect to be the case. You know, Worf mm-hmm. is not somebody who does things just to do things, you know, especially in this type of situation.
Yeah.
Especially, I think, too, because of the lessons that he's learned, you know, especially through Deep Space Nine. And, you know, we saw him making some of those rash decisions that got people into trouble. And he mm-hmm. seems to be very focused. That, again, just a great question that I can't wait to kind of have answered.
Yeah. I wish Worf had shown up with like a giant medallion around his neck and bell-bottom pants. And
like maybe a low-cut shirt, you know, just yeah, look like yeah. Dr. McCoy. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I think on the surface level, disengage could play into this idea that Worf is more of a pacifist now, which we've heard from the trailers and what's coming up. Although I don't know to what extent I believe that, you know, mm-hmm. that's where his character has gone. I think it's quite likely here that he knows a lot more, and that Starfleet intelligence is on the wrong path, and he has right. some information about what's going on, and he needs Rafi's help, and he doesn't want her mm-hmm. to continue with an investigation that's going to get her killed, which it almost does here. And then so he goes and he extracts her right at the end.
I mean, he might be a quote unquote pacifist, but apparently his pacifism has him slicing through people like a Ginsu artist. So
yeah, exactly. While we're talking about this scene, one last thing I did want to throw in there was Sneed himself. I really like what they did with the Ferengi makeup here for Picard. I think it's a really nice update of what we got on DS9 without it feeling like they decided to redesign the alien. I think all right. the characters, all the aliens that we are getting in Picard feel a bit more real and a bit less Hollywood prosthetic than what we got on Star Trek in the 90s. And that aesthetic take of just trying to make them feel a little bit more like actual real people
mm-hmm. right.
without straying too far away from how we recognize them. Like, if we get another Klingon besides Worf on here, I think it'll be really interesting to see what they do with the makeup. But I think that what they did here was really good. And then the actor, Aaron Stanford, who plays Sneed, I really felt like he studied Armin Shimerman and Quark a lot and found a good balance of presenting mm-hmm. Ferengi in the way that we expect Ferengi to be, as someone who's constantly doing some kind of business deal, whether it's above board or it's something nefarious, but also not doing an imitation of Quark, like making it feel like he's his own person.
Yes.
But he really felt like a real Ferengi that we're accustomed to. So I thought that was nicely done.
Yeah, and it was, again, the thing that kind of stood out to me is the way the makeup, you know, we've never seen a Ferengi that shows a hint of facial hair. And so a question I actually had was, you know, is he a combination of human and Ferengi? Because, you know, that's just not something we've ever seen in a Ferengi. Or is he Ferengi and something else, you know? Human would be the most normal, I guess, in the sense of, like, you know, you wouldn't have competing facial features. And so, but I loved that. Again, I think it's a great addition to the makeup and to create a more rounded society. And in the sense of the monoculture also approaches the idea that, you know, everybody looks the same. And not just that they act the same. And so Ferengis have definitely fallen into that, even though there were, you know, variations on a theme as to their personalities. But I thought the everything worked. Again, like you said, I think they did a great job in updating the makeup and making it feel like it fit with everything that came before. But at the same time, you've got today's makeup techniques. You know, even Worf is the same way. You know, his head ridges are not as pronounced as they used to be. And part of that, you know, maybe that's part of getting older for Klingons and all that, which I think is great. But, you know, I thought he looked fantastic. And so, you know, all of this is really working.
I personally think Sneed here is just purely a Ferengi. I don't think he's a combination of anything. And I think that,
I mean,
that
it could be,
little bit of facial hair is part of the updated makeup to make him feel more real. That was my take on it.
It makes him feel seedier too. The fact he has the 5 o'clock shadow, you know,
I think that's part of the concept. And I also love that he has fur. We didn't get to see the whip, but he has fur. So
yes. Likes to collect human things, like old things. Like he's got a baseball and, you know, like all this type of stuff. So, you know, I appreciate that as well. I thought, you know, it's those little things to which you throw in, and he was drinking Sluggo Cola. Like he pops open his cooler behind him and pulls out a Sluggo Cola. I was like, that's phenomenal.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, we have passed an hour, but there's still one last thing we should talk about before we wrap up, and that's Shaw. And I mean, there's a lot we could talk about with him here. Did you see this as redemption for how he acted in the first episode a little bit? I mean, he did allow them to rescue everyone.
Right.
And then at the end, he did finally go along with Picard. Now, the one thing that I'm curious about your thoughts on is when Jean-Luc realizes that Jack is his son and he yells, "Admiral's orders, belay that, Admiral's orders, lock everything down." And then Shaw, after the way he's acted all the way up to that point, just acquiesced and said, "Fine, okay, why are you doing this? But I'll go along with you." Did you feel like he backed down too easily there? Or is that what he should have done as a Starfleet captain in this situation?
Yeah, so my answer in that is a little long-winded, but I think, you know, Vadic says that his psych profile, you know, she's surprised that he's functional, which I'm like, okay, well, apparently this guy has been through some major trauma or something has happened to him to make him the way who he is. And so I think what we're going to learn is that something has happened in Shaw's past to which made him responsible for a disaster. And this is, I just thought about this because I mentioned Tapestry earlier, but I'm wondering if he is a reflection of who Picard would have become if he had been less willing to take a chance. That's what all Tapestry is all about, you know? And so if that he has become this by-the-book rule follower because of something that happened, which Vadic is referencing, and that what's happened here then with Picard, because, you know, he also looks at Picard and he's like, "What is going on?" And then Beverly comes out and they have that incredible moment, and Picard he's like, why are you doing this? And he's like, he's my son. And then his reaction is so human, which is like, well, GD, like, because, and there's a, the way that it's played, there's a recognition, and it's almost as if, I'm wondering if Shaw had a family.
Yeah.
Or a child, and something happened, and that's what kind of wrecked him and turned him into this type of person. Because the other thing that we see about him is that Seven can push his buttons and does push his buttons by saying, you can be the hero who saves heroes, or you can basically be the schmuck who let him die. Mm-hmm. And like, how do you want to be remembered? And so she, there's definitely a psychological profile here, I think, of a man who wants to be more than what he's allowed himself to become right now. And
he's scared to take that step.
Yes.
It feels
exactly.
like he's very scared to veer off of this course that this cautious course that he's on.
Because if he did everything by the book, nobody could blame him, right? Like he, and so I think.
Well, he even says again, whatever happens from here is on you at the end too, right? He doesn't want to be blamed. Like he's okay with taking the action as long as he's certain that he won't be the one blamed for whatever happens.
Right. That he could pass the buck. So no, what I loved is that he's a much more likable character here, and that we are from episode one to episode two, we are already starting to peel back the layers of this character and make him not just a dick, but a real person who deserves to be paid attention to care about as a character. He's not just going to be a one-note type of villain or foil for the plans of someone like Picard or Riker. And so I thought played to perfection. And what I loved is that in one episode, I'm already starting to be like, oh, maybe this guy is like more than meets the eye. Like apparently he's a transformer.
Now that would be an unexpected twist if he actually turned into a robot at some point and a vehicle
that
at
would
the
be
same
odd.
Time. Yeah.
Yeah. As long as they use that sound.
I like that assessment, and I think it makes a lot of sense. And I don't feel about him the way that I did on our discussion last episode when we talked about the pilot episode, where I said that I think that he will, you know, I think I said he might be killed or he'll disappear or, you know, he's going to be discharged or something along those lines. You know, like I do think Seven will rise from all of this, definitely. But I don't think it will necessarily be at the expense of Shaw anymore. I think there's this redemption arc for Shaw, and I think that he will likely continue to be part of the story and play an important role and be more cooperative with what's going on now that he's gotten over all the shock of all of this happening on his ship here at the beginning.
Well, and even the writing for him, you know, and then the way that Todd Stashwick plays him felt reminiscent of like some of the vernacular that we were getting and we get in Strange New Worlds from Pike, and you know, and maybe a little bit of like Tom Paris in there, where he's a little bit more modern in the way that he kind of it speaks about things.
That's true. Yeah,
and so there's just this really interesting portrayal of this character, just that I'm so interested to know where it is that we are going to go with this character. And what I absolutely love is that this season is not allowing us to have one note or flat characters. You know, we're making everybody rounded and we're making everyone interesting. And so I think that is absolutely what we want in Star Trek. And so I'm so glad that that's the case. And what it leaves me is just, I'm on the edge of my seat every episode, kind of like trying to take it all in. And then once it's over, I'm just thinking to myself, oh, now I wish it was Thursday again so that mm-hmm. I can go and watch the next episode, because I'm excited about what's coming and what they're giving us. And that's a wonderful place to be with any show that you're watching.
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't know what's going to happen. And that's part of the fun of doing this podcast week by week like this, because we can speculate and find out where we're right and where we're wrong. And it's a lot of fun because mostly you and I podcast about episodes that we've seen 100 times. And so we're analyzing the story in a very different way. So this has been really fun. And those sound like final thoughts from both of us there. So I guess it's time to wrap up this discussion, even though there are so many things that we could talk about that we didn't touch on. And even the things we did, I think we could really discuss those in a lot more depth, which eventually we'll probably do. But we would love to hear your thoughts on episode 2 of Star Trek Picard season 3, Disengage. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It is a closed group just for listeners. It's meant to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. The way to find it is to type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook. It should come right on up. If it doesn't, just type the whole name, the Babel Conference. You'll find a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. You can also send us email. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose the artificial tango. And your message will dance right over to Matthew and me by email. You can also find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. And we thank everyone who has rated us and left a review so far. Now, Matthew, when you're not taking inventory of all the weaponry on your ship, where can people find you?
Well, you interrupted me, so I got to start again. But Chris, you can find me all over the place on social media under the name MattBrushing02, Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero are the places I'm most active. You can, of course, find me here on the network. We've got the 602 Club, where we're not talking Star Trek. We're talking everything else in fandoms out there, and so I hope you'll check that out. We also do Warp 5 about Star Trek Enterprise, The Orb about Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Saddle Up about Star Trek Strange New Worlds, and of course we've got Literary Treks going. We're talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek. We're not doing those over on the Nerd Party Network. A couple of shows, one's called Owl Post, did that with Dre Kaufman, and we talked through every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time, and then you'll find me doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills, which is a Star Wars podcast, so I hope everybody will check that out. But, you know, Chris, when you're not disparaging Chateau Picard, where can people find you?
Oh, you know, I'd rather have a slug of cola, personally. But when I'm not drinking that...
You're more of a Malbec man yourself, right?
Yeah. When I'm not drinking what we would also call Ferengi champagne, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing the shows with you, which you mentioned. Also, Larry Nemechek and I do The Ready Room from time to time, and you can find me in many episodes in the back catalog. If you'd like to chat with me about Star Trek or whatever, you can find me in social media. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. Twitter is where I'm most active. I'm also on Mastodon on the Trekkies.social instance. C. Brian Jones there, of course, as well. And I'd love to chat with you. And if you'd like to help us keep this show and everything that we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. If you'd like to support what we're doing, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. You can find out how to get involved. You can become an associate producer of The Artificial Tango or any of our other shows. And we want to send a huge thanks to everyone who's supporting us right now. We would not be here without your help. And if you're not involved yet, we hope you will do so. Again, just visit patreon.com/trekfm to find out how, and thank you so much to everyone who's supporting us. Well, Matthew, I can't wait until next week. I know you'll stay up late to watch the episode as soon as it drops, and we will discuss the next installment, part 3 of Season 3 of Star Trek Picard.
Well, I've only got one word for you, Chris. Engage.